You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Hello, and welcome to Curiosity Invited. My name is David Bryan, and today I'll be speaking with a woman named Erica Verba. Erica is a professor at Cal State LA, where she's the chair of the Latin American Studies Department, and she is also a musician, and she has just written a book recently called Thanks to Life. And it's about it's the biography of Violeta Parra, who is probably too unknown in the United States of America, but that's not true in many other parts of the world. Violeta Parra was a musician, songwriter, an observer of the world, and an artist, a visual artist, and many of her songs still very popular today, covered by some of the most well-known artists around the world. And Erica is steeped in both enthusiasm and knowledge of Violeta Parra's life and place in the world now. So I had a lovely time speaking with her, and I hope you enjoy it. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Curiosity Invited. I'm David Bryan, and the other person on the screen who is not me is Erica Verba.
Hey there.
I will tell you what I know of Erica Verba without reading. And that is that Erica is a professor, a musician, a professor of Latin American studies and music, I believe, but a musician. And she has recently written a book, which is almost out.
No, it's out.
It's out. Okay. And it's called Thanks to Life, and it is a biography of Violeta Parra. I hope I said that right. A Chilean musician, artist, folk singer, deceased quite a number of years ago, but very influential to artists and to people who like being inspired. So thank you, Erica, thanks for writing the book, and thanks for coming and speaking. I appreciate it.
Oh, I'm so happy to be on this show. Thank you.
So can I start by putting you on the spot and saying, can you give us a short bio? Because that's what I read was your interest in Violeta Parra started in your teenage years.
Yes.
And has sustained. So can you do that? Tell us.
Yeah. It's very strange. It's sort of strange because I can actually look back and it's like, oh, right. Then I've been doing a lot of that because people ask me about my bio and why I wrote this book. So I first came in contact with Violeta Parra's music and songs. Learned my first Violeta Parra songs when I was a teenager. It was 1974, the year after the military coup in Chile. 1973, September 11th was their September 11th was the military coup in Chile, and I was in high school. And their family moved. I was in a suburb of Boston called Brookline, not particularly exciting place. And a family moved to my town of Chileans, and they were exciting. They were artists and musicians, and the father was studying sort of radical education, which I think would be of interest to you. And the mother was an actress, and so they were very exciting. And my peer, the Miguel, who was my age, was also really angry. And he was really angry because he had been uprooted from his home, and his home was, you know, torched, was under military dictatorship.
So he was the family moved there because of the
They were fortunate in the sense that the father actually moved there to do graduate school. So they had been planning the move, and then the coup happened. But because of who they were and because they had safe passage, because it was already arranged, they did things like, which I'll never forget, they smuggled albums out. So there was a protest, there was a movement of protest music in Chile, as there was here. And there was, as there were pretty much all over the world, it was sort of a transnational phenomenon. And so that, you know, you could say that, there, for example, a musician called Victor Jara, who was a disciple of Violeta Parra, she died in 67, but Victor Jara was active under the socialist government of Allende, Salvador Allende, and he was a wonderful singer. And you might say that he was the Bob Dylan of Chile.
Yeah.
Or Chileans might say that Bob Dylan was the Victor Jara of the United States.
Right.
You know, being a leftist was a crime under military dictatorship. And Victor Jara was a singer who sang about songs for the people. And that was a crime worthy of death. So he was put to death by the military within days of the coup. And so it was sort of, if you can imagine, being Bob Dylan and singing Masters of War would be a death sentence of the military dictatorship. If you could have imagined what that meant. And so what my friends did was they went out and they wanted to smuggle these albums out, because the other thing that the military was doing was they were going through people's houses, taking out the books, taking out the albums, and making bonfires. So think about Nazi Germany, these scenes that you've seen, that was happening in Chile as well. Bonfire in the street of materials that the military dictatorship felt were dangerous. And let's talk about the words they used. It was the internal enemy, right? And I think we're hearing a lot of talk. I'm not saying.
Yeah.
I think we're far away from the brutality. I like to think we're far away
from dictatorship.
But the language is the same. The language of it. Who is your enemy if ideas that you don't believe and that you are against is, if having, if people's ideas are make them an enemy, you know, what does that mean? So, you know, that is something to think about. Anyway, this wonderful family, what they did, because they did have safe passage, was they went and they bought all of this military band albums, LPs, and they very carefully inserted the protest albums inside them. And then with great care, and this was my friend who did it, he was a teenager, ironed the album covers shut, this is sort of the cellophane that's on the outside of the album covers, so it looked like they had never been opened. And that's how they got them out of the country. Moving times and exciting times. And I remember being overwhelmed because my friend was angry. And one of the things that made him very angry was that we didn't know anything about it in the United States.
Right.
His peers in high school had no idea that the CIA had funded this military coup that was destroying his country. And so that was really a turning point in me and in my life in so many different ways. And if I trace it since, I go to college. My first week in college, I meet other musicians. Oh, because they taught me songs and Violeta Parra songs. So I'm already singing these songs and I'm going to concerts. My first week in college, I think the Spanish department said, come, we're having a tertulia, which is like a gathering, bring your instruments. And I speak Spanish by then because I've learned Spanish in high school and I'm through my friends. And I go to this tertulia with my instruments and meet two people that I will actually have been playing music with ever since. And that was 76.
Okay. So, but I'm going to
please
ask you how Violeta Parra figures into this.
Absolutely. Thank you for bringing me back to the theme of today. Well, her songs are absolutely foundational to this kind of music. It's called Nueva Canción, or New Song. And she wrote the anthems for it. She wrote songs that, you know, that are amazing protest songs that have resonated across the years. She wrote songs like Gracias a la Vida, Thanks to Life, which gives my book its title. It's a very universal song, and it's also an incredibly intimate love song. So it's a song that says, I give thanks for, well, I'll read the last verse because I have my book here. And my friends, Nancy Morris and Patricia Vilches, did this amazing job translating lyrics for my book. They just volunteered, and they worked together. One's Chilean, one's from the United States, and they worked really hard to make sure that it wasn't just a literal translation, but that it have a sense of meter and rhythm. So I'll read the last verse of Gracias a la Vida, which is their translation. Thanks to life for all that it has given me. It has given me laughter. It has given me tears. And so I distinguish joyfulness from sorrow, the materials that together make up my song, and your song, which is the same song, and everyone's song, which is my own song. Mm. And so there's this kind of universal message of her music, but also very specific songs about conditions in her country, the conditions of the miners in the North and their wives.
And is there a story about where her interest in those who are less fortunate, or did she grow up? Did she grow up poor? Did she grow up? Her father was a teacher.
Yes, which would make her more fortunate than most children from her parents. Right. She was born in 2000. Sorry. She was born in 1917.
1917, yeah.
And her centennial was 2017. She was born in 1917, and she was born into, you know, in a small town in the south of Chile. So I always say the guiding question of my biography is, how does a woman in a family, you know, family of 10, small town in Chile, in the south of Chile, born in 1917, how does she end up becoming sort of this artist whose music is being sung to this day by people like Joan Baez, Casey Musgrave, who I guess is a country star. Yo-Yo Ma recorded it. And then also her art was shown in the Museum of Decorative Arts in Paris. She was the first Latin American artist. So such a multifaceted, talented woman. How does she come out of those particular circumstances? And one thing that is true, her father, her mother was a campesina. And a campesina, how do you translate it? It's like a tenant farmer. It's someone who every morning wakes up and, you know, you do the chores of a farm. You're not very, that's what you do every single day. If you're at the farm, she did it when she visited her cousins who, you know, lived where her mother was born in the hamlet. But she wasn't an agricultural worker who was tied to the land in any way.
Right.
She was born in a town. Her father was a school teacher, which was really like a certain level of prestige at that point. Right. And he was a school teacher who knew how to play classical violin, and he loved opera. So he taught his children arias. So she has both. She has this kind of very rich trove of songs that her mother taught her that were folk songs in the kind of academic ethnomusicological sort of definition of the times, which is meant that it was handed down by oral tradition, right? The mother learned the songs because her mother sang them, and her mother sang them, and we can trace the roots of these songs to medieval Spain. No, they came over with the conquest. And then her father, who loved arias. And this is just around, so the cusp moment in her life, she's 10 years old. They moved to a larger city called Chillán, also in the south of France, of Chile. You know, just completely, you know, think, you know, small town, right?
Right, sure.
They were lived in this barrio called Villa Alegre, which means happy town. They were not rich, and happy town was called happy town because it was by the train station, and that's where all the brothels were. So that made it a happy town, right? And they, you know, their road, which was a dirt road, was the main road for people, the livestock fair. So sometimes, you know, a cow would wander into their house. It was really like this cusp urban rural sort of place. And right around in the 1920s, when she's coming of age, you know, as a teenager, the Victrola or the gramophone shows up in their city, which it does all over the world by now. And for gramophones are those wind up players.
You don't need power.
So there, you know, people, they had the portable one you could take on picnics. I mean, how wonderful is that? But the music, some of it was by the mid-1920s, Chile's actually making albums in Chile. But before that, it's imported music. People are dancing swing from New York, the best, you know, big bands from New York. And they don't have enough money to buy a gramophone, but in their neighborhood, you can hear the most famous opera singer. So it's this moment where music is becoming more accessible to people, but also it's becoming automated, right? So that's a real threat to these songs that are handed down, the folk music. And that's exactly when she's born, and both kinds of music influence her, but she ends up sort of midlife deciding, I'm on the side of the tradition. Mm-hmm. I'm on the side of what's Chilean. I'm on the side of what feels like it's not commercial, what feels authentic and real. And then after she starts collecting these amazing old songs, but then of course she starts writing. And she starts writing, I think she wrote about 200 songs, some which sound just like the traditional songs she collected, and others which are absolutely really songs of witness to what she saw over her time.
How long is this book in the making?
Oh my goodness. Oh, I love that question. So, I go to college and I play music with my friends. And then senior year, I was majoring in Latin American studies because they said you can't come back to school unless you declare a major. And I looked at the courses I'd taken, and oh, I'm a Latin American studies
There
major.
you go.
Best major. I'm director of Latin American studies at Cal State LA. I highly recommend it as a major because you get to take classes in music, literature, anthropology, political science. And the one, it's just like so much fun. And the one thing that ties it all together is this, interest in Latin America. So anyway, I'm majoring in it and I write my senior thesis. This is 1980. So that's a long time ago, on Violeta Parra's autobiography, which she wrote in verse.
Well, so if you answered the question, if so, if I said, so Erica, how long has this book been in the making? It's been in the making since you met your friend in high school. It's been in the making since when?
I think since 1980, since I wrote my senior thesis, if I hadn't studied the poetry and how she adapted it, which
Yeah.
I did do as an undergraduate, I would have had to study it now because her autobiography is very important. Anybody's autobiography is very important. And she wrote it in a traditional poetic, of the form of
Right,
the
right.
Pessimist. I would have had to understand, what was hers. What was traditional, what she borrowed, what was innovative, because there's all sorts of like there's a poetry. Her father dies, and she writes a poem about everything he left her, which is true. Like the testament, it's a poem about it's a testament, right? Will, that's what you call it, testamento in Espanol. Okay, will it's his will, it's his final
Yeah.
will. But it turns out that there's a whole, again going back to medieval Spain, there's a whole kind of verse. Traditional poetry where you say, this is my final will, and these are all the stuff. And of course it rhymes and it has five chickens and it has, so it's a form, right? There's other ones where she talks about traveling, which she did. She travels with a family circus with her kids once, with her brothers and sisters once her father dies because they become very poor.
Right.
It's a depression, they're hungry, and they travel with a family circus. And so she has a whole again five stanza, 10 line des poem in her autobiography, called, and it names all of the towns she traveled to in the south of Chile. But it turns out there's a geography poem, Verso de Geografía, that again goes back to the Middle Ages. So it's a style. So I knew this now as a grown up with a career and all these things because when I was in college, senior year. I had studied this. So I would say that it started then. I mean, I was a professional musician for many years. I went and got my PhD in history, which I didn't write her biography, which I meant to do when I started grad school because one of my advisors say, don't write a biography, no one will hire you because they'll think you only know one thing. And it was the best thing, best. I mean, I think if I had written it back then, it wouldn't be the book that I've written now. I think
Right,
it took this
sure.
long. I,
Okay,
Chilean.
but wait, I'm going to press you on this.
Okay, what?
So you just said it wouldn't be the book that I've written now.
Yeah.
So when did now start?
Oh, geez.
I
Still
mean, was
a
it?
long time ago. So I became a professor. I
But
was.
you knew a lot about Violeta Parra
Oh, yeah.
and Chilean music and music from Latin America. And at some point you decided to, so I'm really, what I really want to know is in the writing of this book, the book you wrote now,
Yeah.
whatever now means,
Yeah.
did anything surprise you about what you've discovered?
Oh, well, yes. I mean, for the longest time, I don't think I was sort of tongue-tied, it would be the words, or I don't know what. It wasn't writer's block. It was like I was going to write a hagiography. It was quite clear. I was going to write this book that was like, look how amazing this woman is. Oh, and look how amazing this is. Look how amazing that is. And it's very easy with Violeta Parra to do that. I mean, most.
Because she's amazing.
She's amazing.
Yeah.
It's like, why should you read this book? Because the woman's amazing, right? And I was kind of stuck there. And then the more I learned about her, the more I realized how she was kind of, she was not allowed to be exactly. She, I first of all, I was really conscious of all of the sort of social restrictions about her pathways, right?
About
Because
what? About what?
her possible pathways, like here she is, this woman, her brother, who's an amazing poet. His name is Nicanor Parra. He won the prize for the best Spanish language poet. He lived to 104, by the way, which is the equivalent of the Nobel Literature Prize, but in Spanish only. Miguel Cervantes, the Miguel Cervantes Prize from Spain. He won it in the 1990s, but he's a world-renowned poet. So he's the family is plunged into poverty because of the Depression, and he's the first person to get out. And the way of this sort of poverty and the south of Chile, he wins a scholarship to attend this very fancy boarding school that's been set up in Santiago for talented boys from the provinces. And it's got a swimming pool, it's got its own post office, it's got a tailor, they have scientific labs it takes up a huge mansion. It's a huge kind of complex, a whole block of downtown Santiago. And the people that have come out of it have won every prize you can, the National Prize in Music, the National Prize in Poetry, the National Prize in Science in Chile. One of them was president of Chile. And it's for poor men, young boys, young men from the provinces to go to high school. So they'll then be able to go to college. So to be very clear, there is no school anywhere in Chile for young women to prepare them to be the leaders of the country, mm-hmm. or to go to college. So Violeta Parra, her brother says, which is a very typical thing because of poverty, come to Santiago, come to school. I'll put you up. You go to school. So what are the school options for Violeta Parra? It's teacher training school. It's called an escuela normal. It's what happens after elementary school. So it's the equivalent of high school. And you learn how to be an elementary school teacher because that is a proper and decent profession for a young woman to follow. Mm-hmm. Right? That's it. There's no other ones. Musicians, not proper. Musicians, not decent because you're selling entertainment. And that's just a little bit close to another woman's profession where you sell entertainment. Right? So anyway, and she quits teaching school, but the option of going to a boarding school that recognized talent was not open to her. Right. And that's kind of true all along. She's just so she kind of has to scrape open a way for her to get through. And that's one of the things that I realized. But then I realized also what I think is really interesting is how she goes about doing that. And in a way, it's by inventing herself. Right. So she kind of, if she can't become the modern poet that her brother is, she becomes sort of the folkloric, spontaneous wildflower that bloomed in the fields. You know, everything about her brother and about modern male artists is invention, right? They're inventors, they're modern. And she is a wildflower. She's compared to nature, right? And everything she does is spontaneous and sort of unintentional and intuitive, right? These are all women's words, right? They're intuitive and natural and earthen, you know? and this is true. They're all true too. I mean, I'm not denying it, but I'm just saying she wasn't, that was her way to be seen and heard. Mm-hmm. And I'll give one concrete example that I think really illustrates this. She, because she's a crazy, wild genius, when she's in her 40s, she gets hepatitis, she's stuck in bed, and she starts embroidering these immense tapestries that will end up being shown at the Museum of Decorative Arts, which is housed in the Louvre Palace. More recently, in 2022, they were shown at the Venice Biennial. They're really phenomenal pieces of work. Mm. And she's living in Paris. By then, it's 1960s. She has taught herself French, right? She speaks French. She's not a peasant woman in the south of Chile. She's an artist in Paris in the 60s, making these amazing pieces of work. And she asked the Chilean ambassador to write a letter to the head of the Museum of Modern Art in Paris so that she can show her work, right? And he says, no, not for us. And he sends her to the Museum of Decorative Arts, which is really sort of arts and crafts, right? Like you'd have crafts there. And she ends up having a show, which is amazing, right? She's the first Latin American to have a show there. And the show is advertised Chilean embroideries with her name underneath. So in other words, she's not the artist. She's, you know, next week it could be Indonesian puppets with the name of the artist. You know what I'm trying to say? It's like she's the folkloric, you know, she's from Chile, an exotic country, you know, right. You know, and so she's not the artist that breaks through. She's the representation of sort of the third world colonial the naive, the authentic, with the real, what people in Paris are craving, because
Did she, either in her autobiography or in something that you bumped into, did she have an awareness of that, of the world's effort to position her in those ways?
I love it, because I actually, the minute I talk about this letter and how she sent to the other museum, and then I have this whole section of my book called The Myths. The myths of her Livre Show, and because immediately, because she's Violetta Parra, right? So immediately there's like tons of myths that occur about this show. And as far as I can tell, she originated them. So one of the myths of the show, some Chilean, I love it. No, this Chilean is saying, oh yeah, I ran into Violetta at a party, and she said, you know, that she just had this show at the Louvre, because everyone just, you know, Museum of Art, Decorative Arts is too long. You just say the Louvre, right? It is the Louvre. And so he said, yeah, she said she was like, you know, she was told to go and take her tapestries to this guy, and she was given a business card, and she just showed up there, and she got a taxi, and she took her tapestries, and she got there, and she realized that she's standing in front of the Louvre, and she's got her braids, and you know, she, you know, like making her like completely like an indigenous folk woman with her braids, standing like holding her tapestries in her arms, looking at the Louvre Palace. And there is actually a film about Violetta Parra. It's in Spanish. It's Violetta Has Gone to Heaven, I think, in Spanish, Se Fue a los Cielos. And it really recreates a scene. It has her, you know, all dressed like a, you know, very humble woman standing in the Palace of the Louvre, right? And that is just not true. We know from the archives of the Museum of Decorative Arts that she specifically asked the ambassador to write to the Museum of Modern Art, that from there, the Museum of Modern Art wrote to the head of the Museum of Decorative Arts, and that she made an appointment. I mean, this is a very intentional woman. She wants her art to be seen, right?
Got it.
My God, look where I am. There's that. And then there's this other one that I really love. She's friends with Alejandro Jodorowsky, who is a very famous artist. He's like a conceptual artist. He was a mime. He made the movie. So she's friends with Alejandro Jodorowsky in Paris, because all of the museums are friends with each other, and he lives in Paris. He's been studying mime with Marcel Marceau. She is plugged in. This woman, she wants to meet Picasso. It never happens. But she knows who Picasso is. She's not a peasant. Let's make this very clear. Right. And she's walking along. So according to Jodorowsky's autobiography, his memoirs, they are walking along the Seine, and she sees the Louvre Palace, and he says something to the effect of, no Chilean will ever be shown in that palace. We're just so, you know, mediocre, or just so far away, or something to that effect. And she says, mark my words, I'm going to have my art shown in that palace someday. And I, as far as Jodorowsky's concerned, she wasn't even creating art at the time. This was just something she decided. So there's two completely different myths. One is that she sort of happened along the Louvre and, you know, was just completely.
Right.
And the other one is that she was like, she's going to show everyone and be in the Louvre,
right.
And really she never, you know, again, she wanted the Museum of Modern Art, not the Louvre, you know, first. So she kind of ends up in the Louvre, and she turns it around to that was always her intention, right? And that was, you know, even though Jodorowsky never believed that any Chilean could be there, she was going to show him wrong. And so they're just such, they're incredibly contradictory, right? And the conclusion, I mean, do you mind if I read a little bit of the?
Not at all.
Okay. So I'm going to read just the last, how do I deal with the fact that there's these completely contradictory sort of accounts of how she gets into the Louvre, right? Because they're not the same, and there's no really way to reconcile them either, right? So there's that. Okay, it's chapter 8. Here we go. Okay. So I should let you know first that when I say that my book is guided by this question of how does a woman from the south of Chile, you know, a woman without any real kind of cultural capital, how does she get to be who she is? And actually, Violetta Parra actually kind of posed the question herself in a letter. So what she does is she takes her art to the Museum of Decorative Arts because the director of Museum of Modern Art told her to do that. And at first the director says, yes, yes, we'll have a show. And then the selection committee, he said it too quickly. The selection committee says, nah, she's not really well known. We can't do it. And so she goes back. So she goes back to his office and he tells her the bad news and she cries. And eventually he thinks she's magnifique, right? So he gets her the show eventually. But in between, she writes to a friend. And she's very upset because she thought she'd have a show in the Louvre. And again, imagine what kind of chutzpah or guts or, you know, a lack of a sense of the impossible. Imagine what a woman sitting around saying, shucks, I'm not going to have a show in the Louvre. Mm-hmm. I mean, when was the last time you sat around saying, shucks, I'm not going to have a show in the Louvre?
Oh, I say it every day.
Yeah. So anyway, she writes to her friends and she says this: how could I have an exhibit at the Louvre? I, who am the ugliest woman in the planet, who come from a tiny country, from Qian, that's the name of a little town, at the end of the earth. So that is her question. And so, of course, my biography tries to answer that question. And so here I go with the myths, because I'm going to refer back to this rhetorical question. Though lacking in biographical precision, each story offers a partial response to the... Oh, wait, I'm going to go back. Given their divergences, any attempt to reconcile these two anecdotes with each other or the historical record appears futile. Instead, the contrasting accounts may more usefully be interpreted as contributing, each in its own way, to Potta's ongoing self-construction as an authentic artist. Mm. In the first, Potta constructs herself as authenticity personified by positioning herself as a naive woman standing outside an other two, an art world within which she was operating in all actuality with some success. She's already had shows in Europe. In the second anecdote, which appears to have been concocted above all to impress her Chilean compatriots, she casts herself as David. She is a tiny woman versus Goliath, the contemporary art world, as symbolized in this case, by what she affectionately refers to in one letter as a lovely little house, the colossal Louvre Palace. And so then this I'll go here. Though lacking in biographical precision, each story offers a partial response to the question, how does an ugly woman of undistinguished origins from a country on the cultural periphery become seen and valued at the cultural center? The first anecdote suggests that it involved maintaining the appearance of purity and authenticity in the eyes of others, something that her very success could easily undermine. The second anecdote underscores how thoroughly subversive it was for her to pose the question in the first place. For in asserting that she was the author of her own artistic triumph, Potta successfully destabilized the hierarchies of class, race, and gender that would have barred her entrance to the art world where she now claimed space. Mm. And there you go. I think that's how she did it.
Yeah. I mean, it makes it sound very intentional and very clever and good for her. And because was it, let me ask you this question. So do you get, you're steeped in everything Potta.
Yeah.
Is she full of herself?
You know, I'm so glad you said clever. So, you know, I really avoid the words manipulative or even clever. I think she's inventive. See, she's this amazing woman who has so much to share with the world. How does she get seen and heard?
Does she feel like that's what she wants to do this because she wants to share something with the world? Or does she want to do this because she wants to be the person that, the first person that is in the Louvre, the Chilean person in the Louvre?
Oh, I don't think, I think it's, they're almost inseparable. She had something, you know, you have to have a certain sense of self to think that your art should be shown in the Louvre when you've been making art for 5 years or 6 years, have no training whatsoever, and just decided you do it because other people are doing it and you know you can, right? And you're going to show the world that you can. So I think that, you know, she had a tremendous sense of self. This is quite clear. Many artists do. And sure. It coupled with a tremendous sense of failure and worthlessness. I mean, I have to say she had both extremes. And if your listeners don't know this, but maybe they do, she committed suicide. So
yes,
this had a lot
she did.
She had extremes of emotions. And because you really have to believe that you can do the impo- Many people have grandiose ideas, right? That's sort of one of the symptoms of mental illness can be grandiose ideas.
Correct.
And the difference is she did it, right? I mean, she, so I think that you know, was she full of herself? Yes. Oh my God. She'd walk, she talked to herself about herself in third person. People that drove people nuts. This woman walk into a room and say, Violeta Tapara has arrived. She would announce herself, you know, and you know, full name, Violeta Tapara, right? It's like this. And she made a lot of noise, and she'd get angry if you didn't listen to her. And she once told this other friend who was also a woman in a man's world, she was the first, you know, I call them gender rebels, right, for their times. The woman was the first truck driver, and she was in the truck drivers union. She was the first woman who was sort of a union head in a truck drivers union. So imagine what they said about her. You know, basically they said she was a butch, which, you know, that she was, you know, this sort of very masculine woman. And she, as far as I can tell, she really was that person, right? But anyway, she, so the Chileans, that's what that their slang word for her would have been that. But anyway, she's writing, she's telling her friend, Violeta Parra is telling her friend Adela, if I weren't this way, no one would listen to me. So if she wasn't this difficult woman that, you know, got angry with people that they didn't listen, that sort of pushed her way, that told the ambassador of France that she wanted a letter to the museum, you know, who is she? Like, she's telling the ambassador, could you please write me a letter? These are the shows I've already given in Europe. I've also been part of a group show in Brazil. Could you please write a letter to the Museum of Modern Art that I would like to show my work there, right? No, who does that? Violeta Tapara does.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, she was very full of herself. And she also could think that she was not worth anything. Yeah.
Mm. Yes, right. Well, that is obviously not mutually exclusive, those things, right? So other than the fact that she's amazing.
Yeah.
Is there an additional reason people ought to know about her?
Well, I think it connects us to a larger community. So I have to say, this woman is not unknown. She is right. Known by millions and millions of people in South America and throughout Latin America, actually, because her songs are so accessible and therefore so beloved and sung. And also she's more known in Europe because, well, she lived in Europe, but also because Europe tends to be more open to other kinds of things. And she's pretty well known in the United States at this point. I mean, she's becoming more well known. My book is the first English language biography of her, and that's, I think, important. Partly because there are things that I have to try to explain that, you know, if you spoke Spanish, you wouldn't have to. But there's translations, for example, right, of her lyrics and her songs. But Latina USA already did a segment on her last year, right? And actually, I'm very excited because I was contacted, independent of hiring a publicist and all of this, I was contacted by the New York Times recently because they have this whole obituary section where it's called Overlook No More, where they about, I think it's every, maybe once a month, they do an obituary of someone who died who didn't get an obituary but should have.
Oh, wow.
And so the New York Times has decided that Violeta Tapara should have had an obituary in 1967. And I wrote the book. So they contacted me. I mean, I wrote the book in English, at least.
So wait, was that the answer to the question? What? Why?
Oh, I think I've become part of this larger community. I think in the United States, we tend to be very insular.
Yes.
And to, you know, we tend to see movies once they've been remade in great movies like this. Actually, Chile has this whole wonderful movie about an old man who goes into an old age home to try to figure out who's been stealing from someone. And now it's a miniseries on Netflix, but in English and, you know, based in the United States. So we tend to think our world is the world. And then, of course, because the U.S., sort of entertainment industry is so powerful. It is, if you go all over the world, it's what people are all listening to.
Right.
So I think this is a really important, it's important for us to know other people's heroes and that they become our heroes as well. Right. And other people's artists and other people's inspirations. You know, I like to say I'd like her to be as famous as Frida Kahlo, which sometimes works because people have heard of Frida Kahlo, and sometimes yes, doesn't. Right. That sounds really bad if they don't. They're like, well, I don't know Frida Kahlo, so that's not very good. But I can tell you, for those who know Frida Kahlo, I can tell you because of my age and because I'm a historian that, you know, 25 years ago, very few people had heard of Frida Kahlo. It really,
that's true.
You needed a feminist movement, and I think you probably needed the movie in Hollywood and maybe Madonna buying one of her pieces for the world to know about her.
Yeah.
Or the United States, not the world. I mean, but the United States.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If we stop talking now, what would you, you know, 10 minutes from now, what would you hit your head and say, oh my God, I can't believe we didn't talk about
I think what I love about her also, why should people care? She writes about a country and her songs are about a country, and she's from a country that we don't necessarily know that much about, which is Chile. And I think that people would really enjoy learning about it. And one of the things that I think is so wonderful about her songwriting, these ethnomusicologists named Juan Pablo Gonzalez, he compared her to a social geographer. So so Chile has this amazing geography. It's very present. Right now, so does California. And if Chile is sort of the flip opposite, it's, you know, because it's the southern hemisphere, it goes desert. It's a very long country.
Yes.
It goes desert, the agricultural, fertile agricultural, and then these, you know, wonderful mountains, pristine mountains and lakes, and then, you know, the Patagonia. And every single region has a different sort of culture and industry. And so she traveled her whole country, and she wrote songs about the conditions of the miners in the north, for example. And so mining tends to happen in the most barren, desolate places in the world. So the mining camps she visited are in the Atacama Desert, which is the driest part of the planet. And she writes a song about that's called Arriba Quemando el Sol, and it means the sun is burning down on us. That's the line that finishes every single verse. Y arriba quemando el sol, and you can just really feel the heat. And she writes about the conditions of the miners, which is very, you know, you would expect that because they were brutal. But she's a witness, and she always notices what the women are doing too. So mm-hmm. She has a verse about the wives of the miners who every single day line up to get water at the only pump in the town, right? There's only one water pump, and they're there with their buckets, and they're going to go and get water for their home. And they do this every day. And this is labor, right? But this is the kind of labor that most songwriters from her period, who were men, did not see. They might make a little comment like the worker and his wife, but they don't see what the wife is doing as labor. The wife is laboring.
That's not true anymore, right?
Oh, no, not at all.
No, I'm kidding.
But you know, But I'm trying to say, I think there are more women writers. You know, things are bad still, obviously. Yeah. But nothing like the you know, I mean, how do I explain this? There's a person who did a study of the Bob Dylans of every country. He calls them guitar poets. Oh. And there's not one woman among them. And I'm not going to name the person, but, you know, the Violeta Parra should have been there. She was a guitar poet.
Yeah.
And she was a woman. So you know, yeah.
And in that way, right, she was, her songs, well, you tell me, the obvious social awareness and effort to point out the inequity was there.
Absolutely. And what I love too, also, the third thing that I love about her songs, I love that they're based on, everything is first person. I mean, they're based on her experience. She doesn't write about things she doesn't know. So she visited those mining camps. That's why she can write about them. And I think that makes for different kinds of songs. And mm-hmm. She saw the women lining up. But also, they're always first person. So she says, and I came back to Santiago, and I said, and I had to sing this song, right? So she has to, she is a witness. And her songs are songs of witness. And I promise you that if you listen to the song, you'll feel it now. It doesn't matter that she wrote it, you know, before she died, which was, she died in 67. You're right. It's a long time ago. But the kind of the inequities she's pointing out and the way she points it out really resonates to this day.
Mm-hmm.
So So people sing those songs to this day. And she has another song that's being sung by student movements across Latin America, which is a song to the students and how wonderful they are and how brave they are, because they'll stand up to the balas. You know, they'll stand up to the bullets of the police. And in Chile, the students stood up to that. They were rubber bullets, but there's a lot of blind young people in Chile right now because of the rubber bullets of police. And you know, they were protests that were used in protest to put down protests. So, and her song is being sung throughout Chile and throughout the world by, it becomes a symbol of people who denounce social injustice and want to change the world.
Right. And I think that's the thing that is, I think that's why it's so enduring.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. The miners are not that much better off today, right?
No, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, well, Erica Verba, I got that right, right?
Oh, Erica Verba.
Thank you so much for being, well, thank you so much for writing the book. And I will put a picture of the book up there, Thanks to Life, and it'll be there so people will see it. And thanks for spending the time having this conversation.
It's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me on your show.
Yeah.
I appreciate it.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.